Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 4th, 2001. In the Creekside Room this morning is Ina Berkey. Today's session number is BEI 2001-02, and it's titled Church Year's Christmas Cycle. Let's listen in.
Started into this series with a zip through the whole liturgical year. So I think we'll say roll it here. Today we're going to be a little more focused on just the music surrounding the Christmas cycle, but I do want to just repeat a couple of things from yesterday. One being, we talked a bit in the beginning about rhythms. There are lots of things that have rhythm. We talked, you know, the sun, the moon two nights ago was full, and it will come up again full, but it won't be last night, and we really can't decide, well, I'd really like a full moon in 3 days. It comes in a very rhythmic pattern, and the astrologers can tell us exactly when that will be, and lucky for us, it doesn't vary, because I think terrible things might happen if it did. We know our bodies are our biorhythm. If we can figure out just what our sleep pattern is, we function better if we get that much sleep, and the only place that happens for me is here. So much of life is in a rhythmic pattern, and I think that's what we need to think about when we think about the liturgical year. Surely the church can function without the liturgical year, but it does give us some pattern, some consistency of things that happen over and over. We said yesterday that in the beginning, the only two things that the early church really had in their liturgical year was Sunday. The Sunday when they gathered together for word and for the meal. And that happened every week. That was the one thing. And then once a year, they had their wonderful celebration of Easter based on the Pascha, which really Paschal, we talked about Paschal candles, but the Feast of the Passover, which then in that time, in the very earliest time, was just the giant celebration of Easter. And as time went on, by the second century, it had expanded to another 50 days to make it an even larger celebration that then ended in the celebration of Pentecost. And we said that Martin Luther himself said, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with the liturgical year if it gives us something to base a better understanding and a better way to worship, then surely let's do it. But it didn't seem to bother him one way or the other. And so for many of us, and particularly not just the Lutheran Church, but we said yesterday, starting with Catholics and through many of the churches, is the Reformed, the Presbyterians, many of our brothers and sisters all celebrate a liturgical year in some form or another. And even as you said yesterday, your church has a sequence to it. It may not have the names of what we call them, but certainly some of the major feasts and festivals we do have. Today we want to look then at Christmas and a bit about the Christmas cycle, and we'll go a little bit more in depth than we were able to do yesterday. You know what that's all about. We know that it's a wonderful rhythm of preparing during Advent, of looking forward to the birth of Christ, and then to Christmas itself, and then to Epiphany, and all focusing on the Lord and the coming of the Lord. Now, it's very interesting if you look back that the Roman Church really is what brings us the whole history of the visit of the Magi, because that seems to be something that the Church of Rome really picked up on. Where in the Eastern Church, Epiphany was really the big thing. But the Epiphany there was really talking about the baptism of Christ. And in Asia Minor, they went on to talk about birth and baptism and miracles at Cana. And Constantinople, their big thing was birth and baptism. So you see that the church sort of took the season and appropriated it to be what they thought would be most appropriate for them.
Well, aren't the dates for Christmas different in the two traditions?
Absolutely, and I'm going to thank you. We'll go right to that. In fact, then the December 25th that we build our time around was the Roman Church's idea of Christmas, where the Eastern Church built its celebrations around January the 6th and the Epiphany. But it was curious to me, anyway, that the earliest of all of these celebrations is really Epiphany. I would have thought it had been something else. But it's not clear, really, what the origins of Epiphany were. They're not as easily put in Jewish tradition as some of the things we talked about yesterday. It seems to be, in some circles, maybe even related to Christ's death, as being April the 6th, placing his birth on January the 6th. So it's very interesting how the historians have come to wonder or to assign times. We probably don't really know. But by the 4th century, the split had probably come, beginning in Rome with Epiphany being its own thing and then Christmas its own. Eventually, like we said, December 25th was adopted in the East, and in the Western Church, January 6th became with Epiphany. I thought that we ought to look right away at a new hymn that you may not know about, or maybe you do, but let's look to start our discussions about Christmas at 633. You need a blue and a green book.
In which book is that?
That's
in the book. Lit one, right?
Yes. 633. I never think I'll be warm. Then I get warm. It's a constant.
Then you do a strip.
It's a constant.
Well, the temperature's kind of like that, too.
Yes, it is.
Like it.
But I will not going to complain about sunshine in any event.
No.
One of our wonderful hymn writers, and often both for text and tune, is Marty Haugen. He is Lutheran in his roots, although he's done a lot of his writing in the Catholic Church. And if you notice several of the things we've done in many parts of the liturgy that we've done in the evening services have been attributed to him. He's alive and well and still writing prolifically and writing wonderful texts and tunes. We said yesterday, most often the text will be written by someone different to the tune writer, but Marty Haugen happens to be the wonderful one who can do it all. This is something that I thought was a wonderful text, and since I know several of you told me yesterday you don't want to sing, we'll just talk about the text. Awaken, awaken, greet the new morn, for angels herald its dawning. Sing out your joy, for soon he is born. Behold the child of our longing. Come as a baby, weak and poor, to bring all hearts together. He opens wide the heavenly door and lives now inside us forever. He wrote this as recently as you can tell in 1983, but let me just give you a sign of the joy of this tune. Briefly say one thing here. You remember we said yesterday that in every hymn you can look at this and get a lot of information that you may never have thought about. You'll always get the number and the name at the top, but the really important things for us in this class are written at the bottom. We said that text and tune will always be noted at the bottom, and it will tell you who wrote it, both the text, who wrote the tune, probably some dates. And then we get to these very, very strange numbers over here. I said that this is really the meter number, and why in the world would we want to know what that is? Now, this is a really weird meter here because it's 9898 8789, and I told you that you could look in the back and see if there's some other tune with that same meter. If you look back here, I think you'll find that this is the only one with this. But we had said that if you could find the one yesterday, 888888, that you could interchange text with tune as long as the meter's the same. You get the meter by saying awake, and greet the new morn becomes 9, and you'll do it again will be the next 8. So there's a pulse for every one of those, and that's how you get that number in a phrase. Mm-hmm. The next phrase, you'll have those pulses that you can beat out. So that we were playing around with things yesterday, saying that we could interchange O Come, O Come, Emmanuel with that wonderful tune for the Navy hymn. But we didn't think it sounded too good to sing, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel. Now, it would work, but probably it's because our mind has too much in it associated with the tune that we might not do that. But I suggested that one way that it is helpful, particularly if the pastor may say, I've got to have this text to go with my sermon today, and I look and say, we've never seen the text or the tune. This is a dead thing for my congregation. So perhaps if I can take that wonderful text and put it with a tune that's so much a part of us that we can sing the tune and not have to worry about but one thing, the text. Mm-hmm. So that's one way that you can interchange the meters. Sometimes it works in a lot of our modern, more up-to-date pieces that have been up-to-date, meaning that they've been written in recent times. The meters will be so weird that we really can't interchange them too much. But you'll find in the Green Book there are lots of things that swap together. So Marty Haugen, today a writer, still alive and doing wonderful music that I think he has a marvelous talent for putting together his text with the style of his song, because that song, that melody just flows along. It's very easy to sing. He does a repeat in it so that you only got to get a couple of little lines of music and then you can get your text with it. But his text and his music are always put together so that they build on each other and really underline for each other a wonderful piece of music. Now, at the heart of Christmas, you know, we've finally get to Christmas, and there we spend this time celebrating the birth of our Lord. We don't have to say too much about what that means to us, but we talk about that wonderful piece that some of you did not know yesterday, number 42 in your Green Book. Let's look at that for a moment. We said that this is one Christmas piece that, like Marty Haugen, is new. This piece, at least for the text, is just about the oldest piece in our book. Of the Father's love begotten, another wonderful text, but this one puts itself into a tune coming from early times when music was really only one line. The plain song chant that we talked about yesterday that flows and actually, if it were written down in its proper form, it doesn't even have any notation to it. That little line we said is really more of a phrase marking than a bar line, like we're used to seeing in a piece of music. So here is another example of a Christmas text, but from a very early time. We know that 348 is just about the earliest time anybody was writing. Now, that's not to say there weren't hymns before this, because as early, you know that. You can quote from me a verse that says, and after singing a hymn, the disciples went out to the Mount of Olives. But we know that those hymns they were talking about were the Psalms. The Psalms are first hymns that were sung. But this is probably one of the first Christian hymn writers. He's got a wonderful name, Marcus Aurelius Clemens Prudentius. How would you like a name like that? He spent his whole first 57 years being a lawyer appointed to the court, and then, I don't know, maybe he was having a late life crisis, but he decided to give it all up and went into isolation and started to write poetry. And this is one of his hymn texts, Of the Father's Love Begotten.
Could you play this?
Sure.
That's such a beautiful hymn.
Now, many of you, you may hear this as a... often to introduce lessons and carols, or as a procession to begin your Christmas Eve service, because it has the mysterious quietness to it that may build up to the service climax, if that's the way you design your service. But it sounds like this, and we talked in plain song, it's always a flow that goes like this. Thank you. Now, think about where this was sung. If you take it back to the 12th, 13th, 14th century, this beautiful haunting melody is sung in a huge cathedral with all the wonderful acoustics. And I think the flow when I do this, to me, that's the way the melody is going. There's all that wonderful space for it to resonate in. And so not only is the piece beautiful for what it says, but the sound of it adds to what the text is saying. So here are two examples of early Christmas music and something written in the very most recent times.
I'd like to answer a question about Joy to the World.
Okay.
In LBW, it's listed as a Christmas hymn. And in the Red Book, Service Book and Hymnal, it's an Advent hymn. Who chooses that?
Well, you know, I've always wondered that, and I don't know the answer. How's that? I have no idea, because to me, certainly in the Red Book, it was Advent. And so, because to me, if it were Advent, truly, it would say, "Joy to the world, the Lord is coming."
Coming, yeah.
But maybe from the English standpoint, maybe that's how that translates. I don't know. But I will tell you that I use that as an excuse to use it as Advent. If anybody asks, I can always say, well, you know, I remember that. Well, I'm glad that you brought, you know, I put little teasers out there to get your attention about what things we might be. And let's talk about Joy to the World. First of all, you look down to the bottom and you see that the text is Isaac Watts. That's hymn number 39 in the Green Book. Now, if you look in this handy little index in the back where all the composers are, and you look for Isaac Watts, you'll notice that except for Catherine Winkworth, he probably has as many hymns back here to his credit as most anybody. He has hymn texts of 6, 12, 13 hymns in this book. A wonderful person, actually in the 1600s. He's living at the same time as Fox. And his first hymn, Behold the Glories of the Lamb, he got tired of all the stuff at the universities and went home and started to write hymns. He served in various parishes. He had a family. He became chaplain to a family. And he had a stroke which left him disabled, and he died in 1748, almost exactly the same time as Bach. Who knows Bach's birth and death?
And they celebrated, was it last year, or was that Beethoven?
Somebody had a big birthday. It wasn't Bach, but...
And it was Beethoven.
Actually, it was, if you want to do death song. Okay. These are just if you want to impress your friends. Mm-hmm. 1685 to 1750. And around that rests lots of, we'll talk about that more today. Now we said that it says the tune is Handel, that somebody adapted this. And what's curious to me, if you can get any of this out of this, at least we know this hymn tune. Evidently, Mr. Watts is looking at this, trying to think of something that'll work for this, and in his mind, as all of us, we can't get away from the hymn tunes around us, but think about how that one part, you know, at this point, Messiah is really big, and he's hearing, glory to God, glory to God. Now, tell me, joy to the world, dum-bum-ba-dum, dum. So he's taken that little segment and thought, this is great. Here's this hymn tune. And you can also get Comfort Ye My People out of this if you look at the refrain, which is probably in his mind too. You remember, if you think of, here, let me, I can play it for you. Remember this part in the Messiah? Aria, but
right.
Then listen to this. the time, surrounded by music, and sometimes you wonder, is there ever really anything original? We're all a part of what's around us, and I think this is just so fascinating that he took these two strains out of two parts of Messiah, which was the piece, the big piece at the moment that everybody's probably humming, and then puts that with the text that he's written, Isaac Watts, and we have Joy to the World. It certainly stood the test of time, hasn't it? What do you know about Handel? We all know he wrote Messiah, but it's very interesting that he really started out, his father really didn't want him to be a musician. This happened often in those days. And he took him, he had him study to be other things. He was the son of a surgeon, and he just couldn't think of his son going into music. It was no more lucrative in those days to make a living than it is today, unless you happen to get a court appointment or a patron, and that was fine. But he did take his son on a trip, and at that time he had the son, George, had an invitation to play an organ in a little chapel there. And the Duke was so impressed that between the Duke and the father, they decided maybe he really did have talent and maybe he really should be a musician. So he studied counterpoint and harmony and organ and harpsichord and violin and oboe and went to Berlin for a year to study. And at that point, the biggest thing to be writing was opera. So that's what he did, because you don't, you know, if you really want to put a little bread on the table, it's better to write in the medium that people are wanting to hear. So he went, he became a very successful composer of Italian opera, and he was pretty smart too. He did 46 operas, but then people began to be weary of opera, and then the coming thing was the oratorio. Oratorio is very much like opera in the sense that it's got a lot of spoken text. Instead of saying, I am going to the store, you may sing, I'm going to the store. And so the oratorio took religious themes and turned these into a sung story. And that was becoming very big then, so he did that. Can you think of any other names of oratorios besides Messiah? He did a wonderful one that you have perhaps heard called Samson. He did one on Saul, he did one on Israel and Egypt. And then in 1742, he finally, after 3 years, Messiah was heard for the first time, and the rest is history. Now, he did 26 other oratorios. And not only that, he composed music for harpsichord, he did beautiful, beautiful organ music, chamber music. Some of my favorite organ pieces are some of his concerti that he did. And he was really quite a prolific writer, to which we owe much. It's always interesting to wonder how one becomes popular and why your music is loved by the people. He was he had a sense about him that he was able to change with the times. He didn't just have one medium. He was able to have the talent to do oratorio, and that's what people wanted to hear. He surrounded that with music for every other instrument and has left us a wealth of beautiful music. And what's so wonderful about Handel is that it's all very accessible to us. Now, we hear about other musicians who unfortunately either became deaf or blind or something in their time. And he was entirely blind in 1753. But even 6 years after that, he played the organ for a performance of the Messiah in Covent Gardens and died 8 days after that. But he was a musician right up to the very last moment of his death and has left us with a beautiful treasure, a treasury of music. Enough about Joy to the World. You can tell it's a great piece because it reminds me of Handel and all the other wonderful things. I thought you might want to look at one other piece, and that's 51, Before We Leave Christmas. Now this becomes special for us Lutherans anyway, because Martin Luther wrote this. But it's interesting, he used an old old song that was popular, that it was a singing game for the in his day. A young man would sing the refrain and give out a riddle to one of the girls in the circle, and if she couldn't answer it, then she had to give the wreath or the garland that she had to the person who was doing the riddle. Now, if I could do German well, I could sing you this song in German, but I will spare you that. But enough to say that Martin Luther really liked the folk song, so he took this and put the words with it. Now, I know probably you don't get the opportunity to do all 14 verses on it because your congregation says that if they walk in and see this, they would probably leave before the service had ended. But he wrote it for a celebration for his family for Christmas Eve. And if you look at it in that context, you can imagine a family sitting around for a whole evening, and they probably didn't just sit down and say, okay, gang, we're going to do all 14 verses. But the text is so beautiful and so much a description of all the many facets of Christmas. And if you think about it in the context of a Christmas Eve service, I can see how that might be. As I said, at Von Himmelhoff, we said each hymn tune has a name, and it may be the title, it may be where it was written, but it's always fun to look down. Von Himmelhoff from heaven above, so he's just calling the hymn tune the same as the name of the first verse there. And it actually is believed to have been written by him, even though it's based on the little folk tune that was going around that time. Now, our dear friend, Mr. Bach, used the same melody as a basis for several organ works. I have probably at least three organ works that he wrote based on this, Bach. He also used it for a lot of preludes, and in a wonderful little volume of things for the liturgical year, the Orgelbuchlein, a wonderful Christmas piece that Bach wrote on that, a smaller piece that you probably heard on Christmas Eve and just didn't know that's what it was. So here our dear friend Martin Luther writing and in the 1400s for the text and the tune, and then Bach hears it in the 1600s, loves the tune, and uses that to write so many wonderful organ pieces on. And if you want to look in the blue book for one more, I wanted to just show you this because of a wonderful text, 641. This hymn was written actually for the person who's bishop of my synod now. It said that Vida, who is a wonderful composer, if you look in the back, you'll see how many of the things he's written nowadays. But he had heard a sermon preached by Bishop Schneider, and where the whole theme seemed to be about Jesus' incarnation and not just the other cute things about Christmas, he says, rather than the charms of Christmas. So he wrote this text and presented this to Bishop Schneider as a gift for his 25th ordination. The other name there for the music, Paul Mons, perhaps many of you know Paul Mons, one of our most extraordinarily gifted musicians in this time, who has just recently retired. The great Minnesota contingent knows Paul Mons because he served all his life in places around Wisconsin and Minnesota, Mount Olive and Minneapolis, Concordia, at Christ Seminary, and more recently at St. Luke's in Chicago. But for organists, a wonderfully gifted person who has left us just treasures of music. And also a wonderful hymn writer.
I was surprised at how short he was.
Yes.
Or he was,
yes, that he could
that
play
he could
this giant instrument.
Yeah.
What I wanted you to look at for this is the text. It's just not as easy to sing. That's why I won't have you sing it. But I do think that sometime, just make a note to go back and read the text to 641. Well, we can't stay in Christmas forever. We have to look on. And we said that the oldest of all of this part of this cycle is Epiphany. And it unfolds the mystery of Jesus coming through the Magi. And you probably hear over and over again all the themes about light and that Epiphany is where we have all the texts, both in the Bible and in our music, about Jesus' manifestation, that wonderful word, manifest. In fact, we'll talk about him in a minute about that. One wonderful thing that the Blue Book has brought back to us is a hymn that we didn't have in our Green Book, and that was 646. If you wanted to do that, you had to go back to your memory or come up with a Christmas carol book. We Three Kings, when you think about the story of the Magi, I never was sure why that was left out. I'm sure somebody has some great theological reason about that, but it never did make much sense to me.
Probably because it says we three kings and who knew how many kings.
Yeah,
so somebody probably said,
it's something like that. It was probably unknown. We won't do that. Now here again we have text and music by the same person, which is really quite more unusual than it is in the things we seem to have picked up here. He wrote this carol in 1857 and published it in the Book of Carols. He was a leader in Episcopal hymnody. You see that Three Kings of Orient is the name of this hymn tune, and it's not too hard to figure out where he picked that from. For any of us who think about the three kings and their three gifts, I don't know of any hymn tune, any hymn text that lists this any more beautifully than this. And then we get the whole star and light theme in the refrain that we sing over and over again. Hopkins also wrote text other than this, if you want to just take a fast glance at 219 in your Green Book. Or if you think
We Three Kings, that number, verse 4, I like the way that Hopkins has talked about the gathering gloom. One of the gifts, a very strange one, is kind of like formaldehyde. It's used for burial.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a strange gift to give a baby.
Mm-hmm. But he certainly picks that up in his imagery of sorrowing, sighing,
Raise
bleeding,
life,
dying with a cold. And then heaven sings hallelujah, then he comes back to the joyful part of the Epiphany season with that.
Is he related to Gerald Manley Hopkins?
You know, I don't know. I wonder if perhaps they are, because I have to look that up. I wondered that when I read that, because I was thinking, oh yeah, I remember doing poems of that. You remember in the season after Epiphany, the Gospels talk about all the various ways Jesus is made known or manifest or shown to be Jesus the God. And the very first place we get this glimpse, and you know, we hardly get Epiphany started before we're at the baptism of Jesus. We really move through Epiphany. I always want to say, wait a minute, because in many of our churches we don't celebrate the feast of the Epiphany because it's not on a Sunday date. It's the 6th of January, and it may or may not be on a Sunday. So suddenly we've left the wise men, and we're already at Jesus' baptism. And I always wanted to say, wait a minute, can we just have another Sunday of the Epiphany and the wise men? Because I like the star part. But we get to Jesus' baptism right away, and it's always hard to find that music, but there is a wonderful new hymn, if you look in your Blue Book again, for 647. Just mention Fred Pratt Green, another contemporary hymn text writer. He, along with Brian Wren, probably are the two most prolific hymn text writers today. They seem to have a wonderful talent for being able to think about a theme and put it down in ways that we can understand. He is an Englishman. Five of his texts were in the LBW Green Book, but he has a new text here that is wonderful on that Sunday for the baptism of Jesus. If you look at the text with Jesus coming to Jordan and being baptized by John, and then always seems to take whatever the theme is for Jesus and the baptism or Jesus and whatever, and then turn it into something that's accessible for what that means for us, as he does in the third verse. Come, Holy Spirit, aid us to keep the vows we made. This very day invade us and every bondage break. Give our lives direction, the gift we covet most, to share the resurrection that leads to Pentecost. I think sometimes I'll say more about this later in the week, but for a hymn text and tune to really be something that we can sing from our hearts, we have to know it and do it enough that we don't have to think about it. So I think it helps sometimes just to sit and read text, because if I'm too busy trying to figure out how the melody goes, then I can't concentrate on the text. That he set this to a tune that really Ralph Vaughan Williams, another great Englishman, had adapted and called it King's Lynn. This is an English folk tune and new for us. I don't think we've got King's Lynn in our book, in the Green Book, but it was a very familiar hymn tune in the Episcopal Church, so you would find it there. But a wonderful new tune here to use on the Sundays that we celebrate Jesus' baptism. We talked about other Epiphany hymns. I had trouble choosing which one I thought you'd really think, oh, that's the one I always have for Epiphany. What's your favorite Epiphany hymn? When you think Epiphany, what song do you like?
Well, that 650 is kind of catchy, and with one voice.
Yes, we are marching. With one voice is a wonderful addition to our hymnody in that it brings in a whole global idea of music and helps us to understand that there are Christians around the world singing, not just us sitting here in America. This is one from South America, South Africa, which is probably, I would guess that this may be one that we know more than any other in this book. And our young people love it. It can be sung in procession, and it's I suspect that we'll hear more about it in the coming days as I'm seeing the Lutheran Church standing with the Stand with Africa theme, and I'm sure that any of our hymnody from South Africa will be pulled out to help us understand what it means to stand with Africa. But this is really a whole new idea about the light of God, isn't it? And as with hymn writers in today's music, you don't have to wonder what the text is, because when you've sung We Are Marching in the Light of God over and over and over again, and marching, 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 it's a wonderful.
The men at the prison just loved to sing 651.
Yes, another. I don't want to call it praise music, but certainly out of the genre of music in the more contemporary music, and you see there another hymn tune meter down there that we'll probably have a hard time fitting anything else into. Do you also know 649, another light hymn brought to us for Epiphany out of this book, I Want to Walk as a Child of the Light?
I think going back to the earlier ones, the brightest and best of the stars
why
we all sing, as with gladness, men of old,
yes,
with two favorites.
And arise, your light has come.
Yes. Brightest and best, we talked yesterday about Reginald Heber, the great text writer, and here he is again doing Epiphany hymns. We talked about this as our Epiphany hymn as we dashed through the church here yesterday, and all the beautiful imagery that he uses, and then he repeats verse 1 again, sort of like bookends. This is hymn 84, Brightest and Best of the Stars, of the Stars, of the Morning. So themes of light, themes of Christ being made known, and if you remember the Epiphany season, then ends with the Transfiguration, and the time of most light, shall we say. During the Epiphany season, it's usually starting off at least with the baptism. We use white on the altar, white, the color of light. We use white for all festivals that have to do with Christ. Gladness, light, joy. You use white for Christmas Day. Epiphany, we use white until we get past the feast of the baptism of our Lord, and then we switch to green for the rest of the season. When it's neither a feast nor a time of penitence, we use green. That was that ordinary time that's really extraordinary, but they call that ordinary time. So whenever we're into that part of the church year, we see green on our pyramids. Well,
did at one time it was kind of the growing.
Yes,
and
particularly for
green
the
for
the second for the half of the church year, we talked about that being the growing time of the year. Some call it the ordinary. Some call it the time of growth. Some call it kingdom tide. In some of our denominational preferences. Well, we need to move on to Advent. We'll back up now. We've done Christmas, Epiphany, and now we back up. Advent is always a set time, the four Sundays before Christmas. So you have to know from the way that Christmas is set on December 25th and what day of the week that is, that then tells you when your four Sundays ahead of Advent will be. And actually, it seems to have begun first in Spain, and I love this, when the council there decreed that, quote, from December 17th to the day of Epiphany, no one is permitted to be absent from church. Now, what will happen if we tried that today?
Yeah.
It may not work too well. Christmas really wasn't known very much in the early church, except in Spain. But by the 4th century then, a 40-day season of preparation for Epiphany was being practiced in parts of Gaul. And eventually, Rome adopted this 4-week preparation for Advent. I suppose that, I shouldn't suppose. What do you think about for Advent hymns?
O come,
Emmanuel. It would be hard to have.
Right.
That's 34 if you don't know where that is in your book. And what's really wonderful about this, another one of the plain song chants that we talked about, the kind of melodies that flow and have that same style. See how this sounds in comparison. You remember. And then we're doing O Come, Emmanuel. And in 34, you'll notice there are no bar lines there. That's just a phrase mark. And it really works in this flowing, the ebb and flow that goes to the top and back again. And for each phrase, when you teach singing chant, that's one of the concepts that you try to get, that we're doing music in a flow like this. It's never a vertical line. And the way the music flows, it gives a lot of meaning to how the tune goes.
Do you use the Advent season to emphasize the second coming?
Yes, and I'm going to get to that in just a second. Thanks for bringing that up, and I'll talk about that in a minute. I want to just point out here, we said yesterday that O Come, Emmanuel is based on one of our oldest series of music called the O Antiphons, where the writer talked about 7 different ways that we use to describe Christ. And if you look at this, O Dayspring, O Branch of Jesse, the
Lord of Might.
Lord of Might, O Key of David. This is a much earlier set of music that was based on the O Antiphons, and you'll see that in many of the parishes, but most often it's sung as a choral piece because it's quite difficult for the congregation to do. But this is then John Neal that you see here has taken the text out of the O Antiphons and put it into a hymn that's very accessible. The French processional It was always surmised that this was a French processional, but it was only 20 years ago that somebody was finally able to find in some very obscure manuscripts that this, written down at the hymn tune I'm talking about, as the French processional. So, you know, music comes and goes, and we think certain things, but we don't always know how to prove it. I thought it was fascinating that it's only in the last 20 years that somebody found a manuscript that actually showed this as being a French processional. As we said, Advent is multifaceted if we use it that way. Not only does Advent focus us on the coming of Jesus and his birth, but it also has that sense of the future, of coming the next time when Jesus comes again. I think it's really interesting if you look at the prayers of the day, and I won't do that, we could go back to it, but if you look at the prayers of the day, I was looking at Advent, and it talks about, prepare to celebrate the Lord's birth, receive him with joy, and serve him in the present. Stir up your powers and come. That gives us that future coming. By Christmas Eve, we're still talking about coming, the delight and hope of Jesus coming as the Christ child, but the delight and hope that we live in the time waiting for the coming when Jesus comes again. I wanted us to look at number 23 based on the ideas of Jesus. Although this is a really ancient, well, ancient, 400 years is not ancient, but I like this hymn tune because it is in this part of thinking about receiving Jesus as the Christ child, but also, how shall I meet you and welcome you aright? Your people greet you. He comes to judge the nations, a terror to his foes, who love the Lord's appearing. O glorious sun, now come. Send forth your beams so cheering and safely guide us home. That's certainly not the looking forward to the baby Jesus in the manger. That's words to us of looking forward to that. If you look down at the bottom here, you'll see Paul Gerhardt, a wonderfully prolific hymn writer in the 1600s, and Johann Kruger, another hymn tune writer. I'll let you look in the back sometime and see how many other places that are there for that. Paul Gerhardt ranks with Martin Luther as a writer of German hymns. And Luther's hymns are always more objective, where if you look at Gerhard's text, they're a little bit more subjective, unwavering strength and faith in God's love. He lived near Wittenberg, Germany in the early 1600s, and he was, his life is just a, it would be a great illustration for what we heard in Bible study yesterday. Not only his professional life, but his personal life. His wife had 5 children, only one survived. His wife died the time he lost his 4th child, leaving him with a little boy 6 years old. His portrait in Lubens bears the inscription, and I won't say it in German, but it translates, a theologian sifted into a sieve. Yet in the midst of all this, he composed well over 100 hymns, many of them the finest and most beloved of Christian hymnody. Now, when we get the hymns, and they're written in German, somebody has to translate them. And once again, that lovely lady, Catherine Winkworth, if you look in the back in all her translations, she prepared this for a chorale book in the 1800s, and then it made it into the Lutheran hymnal, our Missouri Synod hymnal in 1941. Oh, how shall I receive thee? Then got picked up in the Red Book, and it comes to us by that. You notice that the hymn tune name there in German is pretty much the hymn tune name on the other side of your page there.
How shall I you meet?
Yes, translate that for me, because I don't want to try to do that and embarrass you for how I can't do it well. Now, let's look at 33. Another wonderful hymn for Advent, but of a more current time. It was published in the early part of the 1900s, although the text was written in the 1500s. And the hymn tune, Consolation, you see down there. Now that's not, here we see a hymn tune name that doesn't seem to have much resemblance to the first line, but it does probably talk about the whole concept of what this hymn's about. You see down there, Kentucky Harmony. This was another one of those collections of hymnody. We talked yesterday about Sacred Heart being the collection of the Baptist hymn tunes that are published in Sacred Heart, a collection from the 1800s. People got together to sing these, and they're still in parts of the country, Sacred Harp hymn singings. Kentucky Harmony, another set of a collection of hymnody that was the tunes famous and accessible to people. Somebody writing in Kentucky collected all these in the early 1800s. Sometimes this is published under the hymn tune name of Morning Song. Probably enough said about that, but another, I thought that you might want to just see in the Blue Book, 629, and I picked this particularly because this then comes to us from a different background. Hymn and text and tune written for the Cantillonian people. And if you see down at the bottom there in the really small print, Madeline Marshall, who found this text and tune, translated it, and she's published 35 of his hymn tunes that have been picked up for us. This is the only one for us that's in here.
That Jewish hymn, 630, I love it, but I could never get my organist to play it because she said it's too hard.
Right.
It's a Jewish Yiddish.
I'm going to mention it again because I will have to mention it again for 630. We said this is a marvelous hymn for Advent. For those of us trying to find a way to light the Advent wreath every week, at least here it is. Wainwold, a contemporary of ours, living and writing now. He is the organist at the, he's the director of music at Camp David, which is the presidential retreat outside of Frederick, Maryland. He's just a really wonderfully humble person who's there writing all these wonderful texts. And he knows that the Yiddish music has a lilt to it and a dance to it, and he picked that tune up. You know this. Or if you don't, you should. This is the way. Wreath to light it with this, and we often do that with it. Get your young children to do this. They really pick up on that, the lilt to it. But I'm not saying for a second that it's just young children's hymns, because it's not. The rest of us love that too. So what, you know, on one hand, the church's celebration of the Lord's coming, we say, oh dear, it's been taken over by the secular world. And yet, there are probably some good things about that, because when you put all this together, there are ways that it can really, that the secular world can make the celebration of the Christian world more enriched. And if you think about all the wonderful art treasures that we have based on Christmas that we might not have had we tried to keep the Christmas and the birth of the Christ child just in our own little selves, put the fence around it. But there's so many traditions that come with Christmas that make it a much broader celebration. What's distinct about the way the church does it?
Well, you have the Advent calendar, you know, the light of light, and light of hope, and light of love. And, and the chrysanthemums.
Well, what are some of the outside cultural things that have contributed then to our picture of Christmas?
Presents.
And Christmas trees. And if you are, some of us were sitting around talking last night about images of our childhood, and it was amazing how many of the childhood images were built around the family celebration of Christmas, and not just the family going to church, but all the things around it, often around the table and the food. And, you know, the table and the food of Christmas in the secular world is itself a picture of gathering around the table of the Lord to celebrate. So I try not to get too critical about how we're being invaded by the secular world, but to try to lift up ways that both the secular and the sacred can inform each other and enrich each other. Well, time flies on, and I thought that we should stop here with just one last look at a new hymn that you may or may not know, but you need to, and that's 636. We come back to Vito again. We talked about him a little earlier. He's Slovakian and brings this wonderful combination of, he served several churches that were bilingual Slovak English churches. And Carl Schalk, still living and writing prolifically, a wonderfully gifted music writer. And this first was published as an anthem, so your choirs probably knew it before the congregation did it. But it's, I thought we'd close with this, and I'll read it, but please look along with me. Before the marvel of this night, adoring, fold your wings and bow, then tear the sky apart with light, and with your news the world endow. Proclaim the birth of Christ in peace, that fear and death and sorrow cease. Sing peace, the gift of peace. Sing, gift of peace. And he takes this wonderful image and works it again with the sleeping world. And at the end of that, he talks about singing bliss and repeats that till you get the message. And that last verse, the love that we've always known, joy and light, into one song compress the love that rules our universe above, and then we sing love. I'll just play the tune because it's something, if you don't know it, you might want to just hear it and just think the words to it. We'll all think along on that first verse. Of text and tune, that's not the kind of thing you'd want to sing to Onward Christian Soldiers. And likewise, Onward Christian Soldiers doesn't work with this gentle, beautiful, mystical kind of hymn writing. But two more of our current writers, Carl Schalk, until most recently was at Concordia College River Forest. He has 35 hymn tunes in the Green Book, and he has, I haven't looked up to see how many are here, but this is a beautiful Christmas piece that perhaps you haven't been familiar with before, but something that you might like to take home. So we've gone a bit more in depth today with Christmas.
Thank you.
And there was one question, do you remember it said there, what hymn?
Oh yeah, but the printing press.
That's right, there's some carol here. What carol, and I have a door prize, what carol was written, the hymn, the tune of the carol, to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the printing press? You mean nobody's going to get my prize?
No. have no idea.
Well, let me just play this, and the first person that can identify this gets the prize. And then I'll tell you why it was used secularly for Gutenberg.
Hark the angels sing.
All right, we have two prizes.
Uh-huh. Well, we're a couple, so.
The way it really went was this. The chorus sang Gutenberg, and then the music came in with trumpets and trombones, and they sang Gutenberg. The tune was for celebrating the 400th anniversary of the printing press. And I heard two of you say it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so, Christmas Day in the morning. Thank you so much for coming and exploring this with me. Christmas, a wonderful season of richness far beyond a few carols that we know. And though it perhaps is best expressed in the things that we've been singing since childhood, it's always interesting to get another glance.